Stay tuned for The Cinema Clash, as Maryland-based critics Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl debate the merits of new releases, from the mainstream movies that Hannah tends to favor to obscure foreign films that Charlie likes to champion. It's free-flowing, unedited conversation with an occasional wine wager. Two very different perspectives, one entertaining podcast. Let the clash begin.
Hello, and welcome to the latest Quarren Stream edition of The Cinema Clash. I'm Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net, joined once again by my socially distanced co-host, Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com. Hey, Charlie.
This podcast catches us at an awkward time. We are smack in the middle of our first virtual film festival.
Indeed. And what exactly does that mean?
Well, I don't mind, you know, you mentioned the other night after we watched the opening film online that we didn't have to drive home, because usually the AFI Documentary Film Festival, their opening night and their big centerpiece screenings, they're all downtown, and I mean way downtown on Constitution Avenue at the museum, and then that is not next door to us. So when the opening night film ended, I closed my laptop and went upstairs and got in bed. So these virtual film festivals are, they're all right.
Did you watch the Q&A, though, that came after it?
I did.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that sort of gave me that sense of at least being a part of a film festival in a somewhat traditional way. I enjoyed it. But like you, it was very nice to be able to just log off and call it a night. So that was pretty cool. So, yeah, we'll talk a lot about the AFI Docs Festival that is going on this week and wrapping up over the course of the weekend.
I mean, there are things I miss. I miss the camaraderie before screening starts, catching up with people, head nods. I miss the big screen, the excitement of the whole festival. There's the red carpet, and usually there are some pretty big names there for the centerpiece screenings. But on the other hand, I'm sitting in my living room.
Yeah, it's a double-edged sword. I miss the camaraderie. I miss being able to just sort of chat with people right after the film. I miss running into filmmakers. There's just a big part of what makes a film festival that's missing. But all things considered, I'm impressed by how they are pulling this off. It's quite a feat to get, you know, nearly 60 films together to be available for people to watch at the same time. I mean, they do give us some additional options. You have bigger windows for some films. You can watch it over the course of 24 hours. But I loved being a part of knowing that everyone's watching this spotlight film at the same time and watching the Q&A afterwards all together. And so that was pretty cool. But I've made it sort of a mixed bag. I try and catch the spotlight films with the rest of the virtual attendees. And then some of the smaller films, I just kind of pick up at catch as catch can, I suppose.
Yeah, even though this is one of our two really big film festivals of the year, movies aren't stopping. There was even another wide platform release this week that you took the time to watch while I was already investing myself in documentaries. So do you want to go ahead and lead us off with, I don't even know how you say it. Are they calling it 7,500?
I think people sort of are saying 7,500 just in terms of making it recognizable. I haven't actually seen any kind of interviews like with the star Joseph Gordon-Levitt or anyone else to know for sure. But I did watch, whether it's 7,500 or 7,500, or both or either, it depends. But this the title does actually refer to the emergency code that is given to air traffic control when your plane has been hijacked. And so that's what this film is. It's a German film, and it stars, though, American Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who people should know from 500 Days of Summer, 50-50, Inception, Third Rock from the Sun. I love Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and so I'll watch just about anything with him in it. And this is a very different style of film from anything I've seen him in before. He plays this guy named Tobias Ellis. He's this very soft-spoken American co-pilot of a commercial flight that's going from Berlin to Paris, and it's hijacked really shortly after takeoff. And the narrative is very familiar. you know, it's nothing we haven't seen before in like a, you know, the Flight 93 kind of story. But what makes this one different is it is shot almost entirely inside the cockpit of an Airbus A320. And so it's this very visceral, intense, claustrophobic kind of film. You only see what the pilot is seeing from within the cockpit itself, and also from a closed circuit camera that's planted right outside the cockpit door. And so you are just in it with Joseph Gordon-Levitt for about 90 minutes. And if you are a Joseph Gordon-Levitt fan, then he's always worth watching to me. But this is no joyride. This is not like a fun action flick. He was chosen for this role because he's more of that everyman kind of guy and not an action hero, superstar kind of guy. And that's what this called for. But I think you might actually have liked it, Charlie.
No, I believe you actually appreciate the very small genre of claustrophobia films. I remember Locke, where Tom Hardy was just driving in his BMW talking on the phone. I remember Buried with Ryan Reynolds, which is in a different kind of claustrophobia because he's in a coffin. Last year's Danish film, The Guilty, where we're just right. watching a 911 mm-hmm. operator on his headset. Claustrophobia films can be done very, very well. I think I would enjoy being trapped in a cockpit with Joseph Gordon-Levitt. I'd be all for it. And when you say fun, you know,
it's
hostage
intense.
Films, you know, I think of, okay, Executive Decision with Kurt Russell or Passenger 57 with Wesley Snipes. Those are my immediate, okay, what are some films about airplane hostage situations?
Yeah, well, this one you never really get, you don't know the passengers. They're out of sight. You never see like the majority of the regular passengers. So this is, you are just in it with a couple of the hijackers and pretty much with the co-pilot, and maybe you kind of see some of the routine stuff that goes on with the crew early on. But I think you'll remember the German director of this film. This is his feature-length film debut. His name is Patrick Vollrath, and he was actually best known for his 2016 Oscar-nominated live-action short, Everything Will Be Okay, Alles Wird Gut. And I think I remember that we both found it a very intense 30-minute watch.
What was the I don't even remember that.
It was about like a divorced dad who has the kid, and you just know something's wrong, and you don't know how, you're just watching it going, this is not going to end well. And so I just remember from a very broad, visceral perspective that it was one of those intense watches that just was sort of a punch gut.
Oh, I do vaguely remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is that same guy messing with you for 90 minutes instead of just 30 minutes. So you might want to catch up on it at some point. It's not a movie I'd ever watch like again, because it's that sort of intense. Okay. Thank you very much. Let's move on. But it is whether it's 7,500 or 7,500, it is available now exclusively on Amazon Prime Video.
Well, I still have 3 days left of documentary films. I will crawl out of it one day, but right now I do not see the light at the end of the tunnel.
So, you know, I was thinking about the documentaries. I chose to watch this film mostly because I just needed that Joseph Gordon-Levitt. I needed some sort of something other than a documentary just to have that change of pace throughout the week. But I think it's always very interesting that out of the several dozen film options, you tend to fill your plate with all veggies, and I go for the more balanced meal that includes dessert. So, you know, I think we've overlapped on some of them, on the big ones, on these spotlight screenings. So why don't we sort of talk a little bit about the ones that we both saw, and then we'll kind of divvy up a little bit in terms of what we each chose to, what direction we each took for some of the others.
You know, one person's vegetables is another person's dessert. There was this documentary, we'll talk about it later, I was watching last night, and she says, I was nervous about uninformed people looking at these pictures because they don't understand where these subjects are coming from. They're coming in with just ignorance. And Hannah, you have no idea where I'm coming from with these documentaries. I think I saw the dessert.
I will claim ignorance on that one because we will talk about that and why you saw that and I saw something else. But why don't you tell us a little bit about the opening night film?
I was skeptical about the opening night film. Usually they really start out with a big bang. I remember a couple years ago, they started out with the eventual Oscar winner about bicycling. But this one is right. Boys State. I remember hearing about Boys State when I was in high school in Virginia, and I wasn't nominated, so I didn't go. But it's like, why do I want to watch something about with 1600 17-year-old boys in Texas? And it turned out it doesn't matter what a film is about if it's so well made and how it's made, because Boys State at sometimes is just a downright thriller watching these boys pose and posture and haggle and shout at each other. This was a Sundance winner. Boys State won the Documentary Grand Jury Award. It won an award at South by Southwest, a special jury recognition. Co-directors, Amanda McBain and Jesse Moss. I apparently have seen some of their work before. They produced The Overnighters in 2014, which is a wonderful documentary about a church that opened up its doors and its parking lot to homeless people. And Jesse Moss produced a film that was at AFI Docs last year, Gay Chorus Deep South.
I remember that one.
Mm-hmm. So Boys State is, it chooses about four boys out of these 1,600 to follow as, you know, they run for various positions like governor and party chair. And they took notes about our contemporary political society. There's some backstabbing. There's some fake news. There's some just fake scandal buildup. And at the end, I was actually mad at the end. I was like, why am I invested in this? I don't care about this. But I did, because one of these boys was just mean and another boy was just so pure. Hannah, I was taken in by Boys State.
Well, I actually did attend Maryland Girls State in the 1980s.
Mm, did you run for governor? Ways.
I do not recall running for anything. And so The funniest thing to me watching this film is I'm like, where are the adults? Because I had a vague recollection of there being adults there, sort of running the show, helping to guide the participants throughout this week as to the political process. And this film is largely devoid of any adults, really. It focuses on the boys themselves. So I enjoyed watching it for that. It was a mixed bag for me too. It gave me some hope for the political future of Texas and elsewhere. Then at other times I was like, oh man, you know, these kids are saying, I wish we could really be honest in our platforms as to what we believe. But now I understand why politicians lie, because you sometimes have to lie in order to get elected, and then you do what you believe.
Yeah, there are future Trumps and future Obamas in that room. Mm-hmm. And because they are from Texas, well, I was really sad about one boy who he believed he had to go up there and scream about guns and Second Amendment and anti-abortion. And it turns out in his one-on-one interview, he actually doesn't believe the things he was shouting, but he wanted mm-hmm. the power. He wanted the notoriety and the respect of being elected the one governor out of all these boys, the leader of leaders. And to do that, he had an idea in his mind of what he had to do. And you could tell, especially in the Q&A, he wasn't very proud of what he did.
Right. And I think we learned, the Q&A reinforced, though, that these were all decent kids. Like all four of the ones that they followed.
Almost all.
I think, yeah, but that I mean,
one,
none
there's
of them,
that one kid. I'm not going to name his name, but annoying. He is
there's
not.
One, yeah, no, there was one incredibly annoying kid. But the kid that I think we both agree is the one to watch in the future is Steve Garza. Mm-hmm. That's a name that I just know now I will keep an eye out for, because I do think that very much like this film does show you past participants like Bill Clinton, people who were in Boys State and those photos. And I can see, you know, in 10, 15, 20 years, there being Steve Garza being out there running and this picture of him having run for governor in Boy State being a part of his story.
Yeah, Boy State's the kind of film that's going to come back. I don't know what Oscar time's going to look like. I know they already delayed it 2 months, but it's not going anywhere. This is the kind of one that builds word of mouth and buzz. And I don't know their distribution plan, how they're going to release it, when and where, on what platform. But I can feel it. I can almost guarantee it's going to be one of those top five documentaries.
It could. It's always hard for me. The opening night films aren't always the strongest by the time we get through the rest of the week and the weekend. And so I do think that there are still some big ones coming up that I might like more. Especially if you're just sort of like a political junkie, there's just something to appreciate in Boy State. And certainly if you're like me and you attended Boy State or Girl State, it's a good way to trigger some fond memories.
Yeah, I like their idea of People State. It's time to mix the genders.
At some point, it's going to become a co-ed program. You can just feel it.
Well, the other one that we overlap on is actually not a centerpiece screening. We actually both, I guess, considered it dessert. I think you watched it because, you know, the journalism angle. You were a journalist, and I watched it because it's foreign. It takes place in a different country, and that was my motif this year. So we both watched 1,000 Cuts, which is about a journalist, Maria Ressa. She works as the director, the owner of Rappler, Rappler.com in the Philippines, which is appears to be one of the last independent freestanding press outlets that is very critical of President Rodrigo Duterte and his war on drugs, his extrajudicial killings, his glamorizing of murder, and his fondness for rape jokes. 1,000 Cuts is I have no special affinity for journalism, but man, it hit hard because the Filipino society is echoing American society. They are cleaved into. It's an eerie echo of our own fake news, alternative fact society, and it's in the news this week. There's a lot of court cases. She was involved in the documentary film. And this week, I just read a Washington Post article. One of them came through the courts. I don't want to say really what happened, but it's timely. The assault on the free press, the assault on journalism.
I think it's fair to say what happened, because that's why a lot of people are actually going to seek this film out, is because it is in the news. And so, you know, in essence, this was shot sort of leading up to the court case, but she was convicted this week in a cyber libel case. I mean, that was, you know, basically trumped up charges by Duterte's regime, but she's out on bail, and she has Amal Clooney to count among her legal team, which is kind of cool. And there is going to be a surge of press about Maria Ressa, and there are a lot of journalist organizations that are coming to her defense and are showing their outrage and are doing everything they can to support her because she is a champion of freedom of the press. And so I watched it. Actually, my personal connection to this one is that Maria Ressa was the CNN bureau chief in Manila when back in the day when I was working at CNN. So I had some interaction, at least over the phone, occasionally with Maria Ressa, and she is very good friends with some acquaintances and friends of mine. So it's one that I had a definite reason to watch it, and Maria Ressa is definitely one of those journalism heroes. I think she was on, she was one of Time's People of the Year, like in 2018, as part of that whole Freedom of the Press crusade. And so, it's interesting to watch. So you have the backstory to what is happening and what will be playing out in the courts.
Yeah, for celebrity watchers, watch out for the quick appearances of Amal and George Clooney. This has crossover content with two documentaries we talked about, we saw last year. One of them is The Kingmaker. It takes place in the Philippines, about Imelda Marcos. Makes you very sad about what the Marcos family did to that country, and they're still trying to recover from. And The Great Hack, which was a Netflix release about Cambridge Analytica. Cambridge Analytica comes up in this film. And so there were those two crossover moments. Everyone will be able to see 1,000 Cuts, however, later this year. They're going to premiere on PBS Frontline.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's great that that people will have an opportunity to see it, even if they don't have all the streaming services right now that some of these things pop up on. It's nice that it's going to get some circulation for the average folks who just want to watch it on regular television. Mm-hmm. So what else? You talked about your international slate. What else did you see?
I did. I wanted to be more methodical this year. Usually I just kind of hunt and peck and, you know, it's very random what I chose. But this year I went through all of it. And I was like, you know what? I want to see everything that happened internationally in a foreign country. And usually those aren't the most heartwarming stories because you're only seeing them because some atrocity happened. I saw one that takes place in Mexico, directed by Sebastian Junger. We know him because he was nominated in 2011 for an Oscar, Restrepo. This one is nuts. It is that he shoved in everything. The migrant caravan walking from Honduras through Mexico to the border, drug policy, corruption, narco trafficking, drug labs, poppy fields. It's so stuffed full that I almost took nothing away from it. I saw The Letter, where in Kenya, it is commonplace for someone to accuse an elder, a grandma, a grandfather of witchcraft. And it's a very serious charge that it is a very superstitious country. People believe in witchcraft. And if you accuse someone of witchcraft, you know, there are oaths you have to take. There are purification rites, or you just have to disappear and go to like a, I've been accused of witchcraft camp. But it's really underhanded. It's a way to take away land from landowners. It's the younger generation. That's how they get their land. They accuse their elders of witchcraft and they take over their land. It's, this one's not as sad as other witchcraft things, but it's very eye-opening. One that is very sad is called One Life. It's about the Rohingya minority in Myanmar, Burma, if you will. There was a state-sponsored genocide of the Rohingya. They were shoved over into Bangladesh, and now they're refugee camp in Bangladesh is the largest refugee camp in the world. And we follow one little girl. Her name is Noor Kalima, and what her experiences are like and what the atrocities that she has witnessed. It becomes almost an infomercial for the World Food Program. You know how much they do throughout the world every day. So many millions of lives, so many mouths fed that, okay, I see what you're doing there, but can we get back to the Rohingya, please? And I watched a spotlight screening last night called Portraits and Dreams. So I finished my international slate, and now I'm just watching the spotlight screenings. Last night's spotlight was Portraits and Dreams, about a photographer, Wendy Ewald. In 1975, she went to rural Appalachian Kentucky and taught these fourth graders how to take pictures, and they documented what their lives looked like. And, you know, they said, I see it now from the outside. Anyone who looks at these pictures thinks we grew up in filth and poor. And actually, we didn't feel that way. We felt, you know, as lucky as can be. Not all children in that class were as fortunate. There are some very, very sad stories. But yeah, this teacher went for like 3-4 years out into the Kentucky wilderness, taught these very poor, disadvantaged children. And she went back and caught up with them. That's mostly the documentary, Where Are You Now? And it was quite moving.
Yeah, well, I stayed more domestic, I think, with my random choices this year. I pick things that either I just happen to stumble upon because they're at the top of my email, or there was some little log line that just absolutely caught my attention. The only one that sort of is like half American and half foreign was one called Miracle Fishing. And it was about the 1994 kidnapping of this agricultural journalist from Texas, Tom Hargrove. And I remembered the name a little bit. He was working in Cali, Colombia, where essentially kidnapping had become a cottage industry. And so these guerrillas were kidnapping whoever, mostly a lot of times Americans, in the hopes of getting money to just really fund their drug operations. And his son, so Tom Hargrove's son, who directs this documentary, Miles Hargrove, he had kept a videotape diary of sorts. He had camcorder footage from throughout the ordeal, and it lasted 334 days. And you see over the course of those months, you see Tom's family and his friends and his neighbors and kidnapped consultants and others all attempting to negotiate his freedom. And so, you know, the ups and the downs where they think he's about to get released and then he's not, and the politics and the protocols of not being, you know, not supposed to negotiate with terrorists, but they want their family member back, and trying to lower the ransom so it's become something affordable. So it's an interesting story. The documentary itself was, it felt a little too long for what it needed to be. But it's still an interesting story. And it was the basis for the book Long March to Freedom, because the guy had kept a written diary in his money belt throughout his ordeal. And then those diaries became the basis for a 2000 movie called Proof of Life. So this documentary, Miracle Fishing, is
connected.
Remember
that movie? That's where Russell Crowe and Meg Ryan had an affair in real life.
Is that? Yeah, I'm not sure if that's in the, if that's at all relevant to the documentary, but yeah. But so if you, if that story is intriguing, then I'm not sure who's going to, you know, where you'll be able to find Miracle Fishing, but that's what that one's about. The one that I think you will be able to see, I think just later in July, is called The Fight. And that's one that's been very relevant in the news. It follows four big cases out of dozens that the American Civil Liberties Union has been fighting on behalf of the people in response to some very perverse Trump administration policies. So the cases involve immigration rights, the family separated at the border, remember them? Mm. And reproductive rights. There's an immigrant teen who's in U.S. custody who was being denied access to an abortion. There was a case about voting rights as potentially impacted by including that citizenship question on the census. And then there was a fourth case about LGBT rights relating to the ban on transgenders in the military. So The Fight takes a very interesting look behind the scenes of the ACLU, and you meet five lawyers who are very passionate and dedicated to what they're doing. And it plays a bit like a recruitment or fundraising video for the ACLU at times, but at the same time, it really does a good job of showcasing why we still very much need the ACLU, which is celebrating 100 years.
Yeah, I'm going to watch it this evening. It is the next Centerpiece Spotlight screening.
Well, and then there's another one that's the surprisingly most relevant that I've seen that I had no idea going in what it was going to be about, other than it was the title made it sound like, sure enough, it was going to be about female police officers. And it was not one of those films that was really getting much attention, but I'm surprised that it wasn't moved up in the ranks a little bit. But it's called Women in Blue. And it followed the first female police chief in Minneapolis, this woman, Janae Hartow, as she was working to reform the Minneapolis Police Department by getting rid of bad cops, retaining the rest of them, promoting more women. She became chief in 2012, but she was forced to resign in 2017 in the aftermath of, there was that fatal police shooting of an Australian-American woman who had called 911 to report a sexual assault in her alley, and she ends up getting shot by the cops. Mm-hmm. And then this was filmed between 2017 and June of 2019. And so you can imagine what might have happened if the cameras were still rolling when the George Floyd killing happened. But you see throughout this film how the Black Lives Matter movement was already, you know, up in arms about the disparity between the treatment of when, you know, the difference between when a Black man was killed by a white police officer versus when a white woman is killed at the hands of a police officer. And it also reveals just how complex and, you know, how tough it will be to ever implement police reform. And so you see through this film how, though Minneapolis was literally, I would say, one officer-related killing away from the movement, from everything just sort of exploding, and public outrage exploding. And so that's what we now have. And so from a timeliness perspective, There's one Black female officer who is featured pretty prominently in the documentary, and it's a sergeant. Her name is Alice White, and she was this constant voice of reason and hope and a champion of de-escalating the situation. And it just made you think at the end, wow, we just need more Alice Whites out there, in the police force, on the streets, and sort of sharing her philosophy on how you can de-escalate and how you are a part of the community. And so I actually was just very pleasantly surprised to just have stumbled across this documentary, because I just think to see a few years leading up to what happened with George Floyd, it was just sort of serendipitous that this documentary happened to be coming out now in this year's AFI Docs.
Yeah, easily earns the most timely award. Even though Maria Ressa was convicted just this week and splashed across international news, it still won't win the timeliness award that this documentary will.
Yeah, and I did see a 13-minute short that I think is actually available through the New York Times website. It's a New York Times documentary called The Lost Astronaut, and it features an interview with a Black sculptor, poet, and one-time astronaut prospect named Ed Dwight, not to be confused with white astronaut Ed White.
Yeah, I remember he was in The First Man,
Right, but Ed Dwight was a test pilot who was recruited in 1963 to become the first Black astronaut. And so he had entered this Air Force training program from which NASA astronauts are selected. And I first heard his story and was really floored by it while watching last year's epic space series, Chasing the Moon, at AFI Docs. And essentially, Dwight contends that Chuck Yeager was a racist who encouraged others in the program to ignore him in the hopes that he would just simply wash out of the program. Ultimately, he was not selected by NASA, and he resigned from the Air Force in 1966. And so it's I remember just hearing his story and just being amazed that I knew nothing about it to begin with. And so this 13-minute documentary, you hear from Ed Dwight. And it's just an interesting 13-minute watch.
Hmm. Yeah, sounds like a good one.
Yeah. And then while you were watching Portrait and Dreams, the centerpiece screening, I did opt for Dads, which I think is one that most people will have heard about by now, because Bryce Dallas Howard, the actress and daughter of Ron, and Ron Howard have been pretty much, on the publicity trail with this film. It is the directorial debut, feature film debut from Bryce Dallas Howard. And it is a very sweet, poignant, funny homage to all the great dads out there. It's got a mix of comedian dads and her own dad and her brother, who's now a new dad. And then a bunch of sort of dad heroes and vloggers from the U.S. and there's a guy in Brazil and another guy in Japan that she focuses on. And it's just a nice little gem that's available now on Apple TV Plus, just in time for Father's Day. So for Father's Day, Charlie, I think you might want to watch that one.
Yeah, I noticed it was premiering today. It started at like 3 o'clock in the morning, that available on Apple TV. So I like when they, at a film festival, you can tell everybody, all right, this one you can't see until next year. This one you can't see until the fall. Well, this one you can log on and watch.
You can see
today.
Right now. Yeah. And so, before I forget then, for you, Charlie, and all the dads out there, including my own, just want to do a little happy Father's Day shout out.
Hooray. Thank you very much.
Yeah. So what have we still got left to see, though? Because, since we are sort of wrapping our AFI Docs coverage in the next 2 days, there are a couple of big ones that I think I'm actually quite looking forward to. How about you?
Well, I got a doubleheader tonight. Every year they do a Guggenheim Symposium. They celebrate the work and life of one documentary filmmaker. And this year, tonight, will be Lee Grant, who directed 1986's Down and Out in America, which is about the people left behind in the Reagan economy. And after that, I'm going to catch up with The Fight, which you already talked about. And I believe, I'm very much looking forward to the closing night film, Jimmy Carter, a Rock and Roll President. I've heard good things about that, and that's definitely in my must-see list.
Yeah, mine too. I did not realize that the former president had this, like, huge love of music and that all these different artists had come through the White House during his tenure. So I'm looking forward to that one too. That will be the closing night film. And then the final spotlight film that I'm definitely going to see and look forward to. We know about Bryce Dallas Howard doing her documentary. Well, Dad's got one in here too, and it's called Rebuilding Paradise. It's a Ron Howard film about the California town of Paradise's recovery from devastating wildfires. And so Ron Howard knows how to make a good documentary. His pacing is always good. He knows how to find good characters and story. So I'm looking forward to Rebuilding Paradise.
Yeah, he's all over the place. I just saw Ron Howard in Josh Gad's YouTube channel. He's been doing this series called Reunited Again, where he brought back the cast of The Goonies and the cast of Back to the Future and Ghostbusters, and they're wonderful watches to see everybody get together again and tell funny stories and repeat funny lines. And Ron Howard showed up with the reunited cast of Splash. And I was like, I forgot that Ron Howard directed Splash. He was so young back then, and it was such a good time to watch that.
Wow, yeah, I forget about that. It is amazing. Even when you're watching Dad's, you see Ron Howard and his own father when Ron Howard was just like a six-year-old starring on the Andy Griffith Show as Opie. And so his dad needed to be there to read the scripts for him because Ron didn't know how to read yet. And so when you think about the longevity of career that Ron Howard has had, and just as an actor, and then to become such a successful director, it's very impressive. So so that's good. I'll have to look for those YouTube shorts. And then next week, do we return to some sense of cinematic normalcy, perhaps?
Yeah, let's get back into actual films. We took a week off last week where I ended up watching the latest Spike Lee, Five Bloods. If you remember, a few months ago, we did our top five most anticipated films of the year, and Five Bloods was my number five, because I always wait and line up for the new Spike Lee film. But next week, we're going to really get back into mainstream fare with one you've already saw. You saw right before everything got locked down, called My Spy. Mm-hmm. And we're also going to see the new Jon Stewart directed film starring Steve Carell, Irresistible.
Yep. And then I've put my feelers out in hopes of getting a preview link for Eurovision Song Contest, The Story of Fire Saga, which looks just like a fun sort of American Idol type of spoof that is coming out on Netflix. So I'm hoping to also catch that one.
Yeah, I didn't ask for that. Let me know how that goes.
Oh, come on. You're going to be missing out. It looks stupid fun, man. but you know, these real theater movies, as I like to call them, they're the ones that I would have gone under normal circumstances to a theater for a screening. But right now, I would say these are still probably best seen at home for the safety of everyone. I know you were talking earlier, you mentioned the AMC backlash that's happening right now. So what's your thought on that?
Man, AMC just stepped in it. They had already made waves saying, we're not going to show any films from Universal because they, you know, distributed Trolls online and skipped theaters. Now AMC, the CEO, Adam Aaron, tweets yesterday, AMC is coming back, folks. We're coming back and we will not require you to wear masks. We don't want this to become a political controversy. Well, guess what? By saying that, it became the ultimate political controversy, because for whatever reason in the United States, wearing a mask has become political. If you wear a mask, you obviously feel one way. And if you don't wear a mask, you feel another way. So AMC is saying, up to you. You don't have to wear a mask. So now you got one side saying AMC is going to infect anyone who goes to the movies. AMC says, but we're going to leave one seat vacant on all sides. Half capacity. Not sure how much that'll work. Then you got another side saying, hey, AMC, you have a responsibility to your patrons to not infect them. And, you know, people are said, hey, that's up to the states. It's up to the states to make the law, to make something mandatory, not a company. So AMC on all sides can do nothing right now. And it's going to become a personal choice whether or not you step foot in a movie theater in the month of June or July.
Yeah, because as we've mentioned before, it's not completely new, this discussion, this debate. Cinemark and Regal, I think, had very similar kinds of policies that they were planning to put out there, where basically it was like, yes, we want people to wear a mask, but we're not going to, you know, throw you out if you don't. So AMC just, they need a little lesson in crisis management and not stepping in it. Because I think that's the problem, is just that that there's now this groundswell of debate and consternation and backlash and about mask policies. And so it'll be interesting to see how it all plays out and when anybody steps into a theater again, and whether the movies that they have to choose to play in the theater are based on one's political bent, which is going to be a very interesting way to roll out film.
I say to skip the middleman and go to the inevitable conclusion when Netflix, Amazon, and Apple buy all the movie theater chains, because they will.
Okay. There you go.
Heard it here first, folks.
All right. So I think that's a wrap for this week. Thanks so much for joining us. As always, stay safe, wash your hands, wear a mask.
Thank you very much.
The Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl is heard twice each weekend at 5:15 on Saturday and 12:15 on Sunday afternoon. Join us again next time for The Cinema Clash.